Welcome, my name is Eric, and this is my podcast. Not in a creepy way.
Just like a constant punch in the balls until it's not.
Come on, don't ruin it for me.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from out of my head, who knows.
I mean, I just have nothing bad to say about pie. I'd recommend it to anybody for any reason.
Oh, come on.
Luckily it's on your end. Ha ha.
Oh, I was so much better before that knowledge. Thank you for ruining my evening.
It's okay. I'll just edit out my stupid comments.
Of course,
it'll be just fine.
Of course you will. You'll take it out in post.
My name is Eric.
I am Brother Jay.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 2002 movie Big Trouble, directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, and starring, an all-star cast.
Yeah, no, there's a ton of people in it. A ton of people I rather mostly like.
Yeah, so now, just to start off, don't you wish you saw this when it came out?
I most definitely do.
I mean, it was a shame. I mean, this movie actually didn't make any money. In fact, it lost a ton of money. We'll explain why a little bit later. But this is a big recommend for me as far as everybody out there. You should go and search out this movie. It was a novel by Dave Barry, the columnist. And I'm just going to actually read a quick synopsis here, written off of, I believe it was either the Wikipedia or it could have been IMDb, but it was written by a guy named Michael G, just J-I. And the only reason I'll read this to summarize it is because the plot itself, I don't think, it's just too wacky to even worry too much about spoiling anything. Just the cast of characters is pretty fantastic. Okay, the plot is as follows. A chain of events starts with the arrival of a mysterious suitcase in Miami. Arthur Herc, played by Stanley Tucci, a corrupt business owner, wants to get his hands on the case. At the same time, two hitmen, Dennis Farina and Jack Keller, want him whacked. Tired of his constant fixation on drinking and television, Herc's wife Anna, which is Renee Russo, and daughter Jenny, Zoe Deschanel, decide to find a new love interest in divorced dad Elliot, Tim Allen, and his son Matt, Ben Foster. To add more complication, two thieves, Tom Sizemore and Johnny Knoxville, decide to steal the case and lead a Miami police team, Jeanine Garofalo and Patrick Warburton, and two FBI agents, Heavy D and Omar Epps, on a wild goose chase that ends inside the Miami airport terminal. Now also in the mix is a homeless guy who lives in a tree on the Herc property, Jason Lee, and the Herc's maid, Sofia Vergara, as well as DJ Qualls, Mike McShane, and Andy Richter, and then a cameo or two that we don't want to spoil. So what'd you think?
I didn't love it as much as you did. There were some very funny parts that made me laugh out loud a couple times, but the story really didn't, I don't know, it didn't compel me to really laugh that all that much. I mean, it was amusing, but it was kind of a meh movie, if you will, to me. And maybe had I read the book, it would have, I don't know if, had I read the book, would it have been any funnier or not, but to me, it just seemed like one setup after another of kind of like this just successive series of bad jokes.
Well, then maybe you got it right, or maybe, the public got it right, giving it like a 48% on Rotten Tomatoes and not making any money.
Like I said, there's some very funny parts in it. I think one of the funniest parts that made me actually guffaw and belly laugh the greatest is when Stanley Tucci is trying to shove Sofia Vergara's foot in his mouth.
Oh, it is hilarious.
That is one of the funniest things I've ever seen anywhere. But that was kind of the apex of the humor for me. And it wasn't like it was a horrible movie. It just was kind of like, it had some funny parts, and it was dated though. It hasn't held up all that well. And I don't know who the other mobster guy was, but I really didn't like him, and I think that was also kind of detracting. And I think maybe you weren't supposed to like him, but there was a lot going on in that movie too. It seemed to me like that perhaps at one point this movie had intended to have a much longer story with some much bigger subplots. And they kind of went, well, no, we're going to do this.
The novel, which I highly recommend, explores all of the subplots a lot more fully. And the characters are much richer. Like the Jack Keller, the guy who plays the second hitman. I mean, Dennis Farina is fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just great. It's right. He's spot on. Stanley Tucci is Stanley Tucci. He's amazing. Rene Russo, I was surprised. I didn't like her character at all.
Yeah, and exactly. I mean, I like her fine, but the character was kind of, you know, unimportant. I mean, she was integral to the plot, I guess, but I don't know. There was just, I think actually it suffered from too many people.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're right. And the fact that in the novel you get to develop the relationship between Anna Herc and Elliot Arnold is, you know, is much better, because that way, you know, the Anna Herc character is a real person with real feelings. And in this, Rene Russo just shows up and she and Tim Allen have this obvious attraction and just sort of go at it from the beginning, which in the sense of the movie is fine. But yeah, if they had more time to develop that, it would make it seem more real.
Yeah, and I think that also would have given some gravity to the characters, which would have led to, you know, that depth and that character development. Is when you have that kind of story, you want that kind of depth. But clearly, I just think that it was too many directions at once. And some of those directions were very funny, and some of them were kind of like, this didn't need to happen.
There were too many main characters, because, you know, Stanley Tucci is probably the best actor in this bunch. Dennis Farina is, you know, a close second as far as that goes. Tim Allen, who's the main character in the novel, you know, the Elliot character and his son, that relationship is the main thrust of the whole novel. In fact, it ends slightly differently in the novel because he's the bigger character. And so his relationships kind of set the stage for everything. And then all the hitmen and the stupid criminals and the FBI and the police are all sort of secondary to this big through line. But in this case, because they steal the show, I mean, I really like Jeanine Garofalo and Patrick Warburton as the cops.
Me too.
And I think it's probably the last Jeanine Garofalo role that I really, really liked. I mean, she just plays the Jeanine Garofalo. Of course, because of the time, you know, she fell on hard times after this because of the whole politics of this nation. But, I mean, she played her character great. And I didn't recognize Zooey Deschanel at first. But then as soon as she started talking, it makes perfect sense. And, you know, those lines between the kids were delivered well, and that was all part of the book, too, that made it more fun.
I would agree.
Yeah. And Michael McShane does a hilarious job. And that all, the beginning all worked just fine as far as I was concerned.
The couple of problems that I really had with it were that I was very much distracted by Tom Sizemore and Johnny Knoxville, because I've seen both of them in such different roles, and seeing them both in this role, all I kept thinking was Jackass and Drug Addict, like Celebrity Rehab, and it was distracting to me. And so I almost wish I had to see, and that's why, you're right, I absolutely wish I had seen it when it had come out, when it was fresh, as it were, because I think that kind of took some of it away, if you will.
Well, and I don't, you know, the Tom Sizemore, Johnny Knoxville characters are pretty much performed as written. However, I didn't really like Johnny Knoxville. He just didn't give he just wasn't the right person for that role.
Tom Sizemore also, why?
Well, exactly. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen Tom Sizemore in a pure comedy role like this before. And he does fine with what he's given. But of course, yeah, I look at him and I think of all those Quentin Tarantino roles, and also using the Wizinator to try to fake a drug test in his real life. So, you know.
And of course the goats, I laughed out loud with the goats. And so, you know, there, like I said, there were some very, very funny parts. There were really some gems in there. You know, Jennifer Jason Leigh, I knew the moment that Sofia Vergara set eyes on him, I said out loud, Jesus. And Derek laughed because I was right. So, you know, there's some very funny parts. I wish that some of those would have been developed better than others. But again,
hold on. Just to be clear, you refer to Jason Leigh as Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. That was a mistake.
That's hilarious. I'm like, Jennifer Jason Leigh wasn't even in the movie, but. Oh, sorry, that's Jason funny. Lee. Oh, that's hilarious.
I might
call him Jennifer Jason Leigh forever anyway, just because of that. That makes me laugh.
Yeah, I don't know where that came from out of my head. Who knows?
No, it's beautiful. No, I thought actually Jason Leigh played it correctly, because the Puggy character was just exactly like that on the page.
I would think that out of all everything, yeah. And I mean, I think he was probably the most, in as much as is impossible in any of this movie, he was, I think, the most realistic of any of the characters. Because he was just kind of this dumb dude who just kind of stumbled into everything and was like, okay.
Yeah, well, Sofia Vergara did a great job, I thought. I mean, I barely recognized her, too. Of course, this movie is 12 years old, so.
Oh, I recognized her. The voice and the screaming and the running and is very much her thing. And like I said, the Stanley Tucci foot thing was, I had to stop the movie because I couldn't stop laughing.
Oh, it was an acting class. That was all about.
Oh yeah. Oh, and Stanley Tucci really sold it. I give him credit. I don't know how they did it. I don't know if there was some kind of fake foot or if it was actually her foot, but he definitely sold the part.
Oh yeah. Well, Stanley Tucci is a national treasure as far as I'm concerned.
I like him in some roles. I don't like him in other.
Oh, see, so. I'm a big Tucci fan, but yeah, I mean, there were some things like the Andy Richter in his two parts. He plays twins. You know, that was, I don't know, he was way over the top, and that was not his fault. I mean, that was the way it was written, too. I thought it was interesting to see a very, very young DJ Qualls.
Yeah, and that he really hasn't aged much.
No, he was the weirdo-looking guy even back then.
Yeah, now he's just gotten more weird-looking.
Yeah, maybe a little taller, but just as thin.
Yeah. Maybe even more thin, because he's taller.
And then I didn't really like Heavy D so much. Although he delivered his lines just fine. But, you know, they were important to the story, so. But I just like the fact that Michael McShane's character that does flow through the, like, all of the plot lines are all, they're not all necessarily tied together with Tim Allen, although they actually end up being. But they're definitely all tied together with him.
Yeah, it was interesting to see Mike McShane, because I don't, you know, you and I may have a different, you know, my first exposure to Mike McShane was the very British, Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Oh, absolutely. As the musical guy. And he also played, I think, Friar Tuck in Robin Hood Men in Tights.
Was he in that, or was he in the actual Costner abomination?
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure it was Men in Tights. I mean, we can look it up, but I'm pretty sure.
Because I really liked Men in Tights. I wish that I had never in my entire lifetime seen that horrible Kevin Costner movie.
It was fine. It's when I was visiting England, we went to the castle where that was filmed, the Prince of Thieves movie, and it was closed on account of rain.
What?
Yeah, we couldn't go into the castle because it was raining.
How?
And it's England. It rains freaking every day, as far as I can tell.
Mike McShane is Friar Tuck in the Costner Robin Hood.
Get out of town. So was he in Men in Tights also, or was that somebody else?
I don't know. I'll have to look now, but it was killing me. See, I knew. And the reason I know,
Oh, that's funny. I was totally wrong then.
Horrible, horrible movie.
He could not have been in both, so it must have just been the Prince of Thieves.
Oh, why couldn't he have been in both? He could have been in both. I mean, I'm not saying he is. I'm just saying, you know, he's probably as good a whore as anyone, so.
Well, yeah, he's a working actor, right?
Well, and not a wildly, wildly, you know, successful actor, so.
Well, and he would fit in the call sheet as a Friar Tuck type.
Right. Well, because he's big and semi-balding. He's
bald and fat. That's
right. Like, well, I was trying to be more politically correct, but realizing also that I'm rather spherical myself, so.
Oh, are you kidding? I was looking in there at his cheesy goatee thinking, wait, if I shave my head a little bit, I am Mike McShane. Oh, well.
Yeah.
But that's okay. There are worse people to be.
I mean, Robin and Men in Tights, so that was 93. I love the internet. Which is, you know, I'm very fond of that movie.
Well, who was Friar Tuck in that movie?
And the internet will fail me, because no,
well, it's
I don't.
Probably, God knows, it's what? Like, it's probably not even Friar Tuck. It's probably like Rabbi Tuckenstein.
Yeah, see, I'm looking at the list, and the Prince John, Sheriff of Rottingham, Marion, Blinken, Achu, A Sneeze, Brunhilde, Little John. Rabbi Tuckman.
Rabbi Tuckman. Okay, yeah, there we go. All right.
Well, who was Rabbi Tuckman?
That was Mel Brooks.
Very good.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, all right. Huh.
And Tracy Ullman is Latrine. See, Robin Hood, Men in Tights, well, we've now completely shifted topics. So
that's
anyway,
okay. That's fine.
We've gone down a wormhole, but I knew it was Mike McShane and Robin Hood. And the reason that I remember that horrible abomination of a movie, because it was the first year I worked at the movie theater. No, that was, I would have been at the movie theater, let's see, 2 years by then, in 91.
When Prince of Thieves came out?
Yes. So 89, 91, because I quit right about, was it Terminator 2, maybe? No, that can't be right. Terminator, must have been Terminator 3.
Now, I've got a question for you about, specifically about Kevin Costner.
Sure.
Are you not a Kevin Costner fan?
I have varying levels of like and dislike of Kevin Costner.
Well, that's fair enough.
And I think largely it depends on the role and his act. For instance, Field of Dreams is a fantastic movie, but he plays a stupid idiot, so pretty good there.
Well there okay, a stupid idiot or simple man of the people.
All right, well, that's more diplomatic, so certainly.
Okay.
You know, Bull Durham, another great Costner movie. You know, Dances with Wolves, which people will roll their eyes, was a great movie. And, you know, and Kevin Costner, not his greatest role, but, you know, certainly it's a great movie and, you know, he does well in it. But Robin Hood, I couldn't even be bothered to try and learn a British accent.
Okay, I see.
Which is a joke. That, I mean, I'm not even original there, but that's just one thing.
Oh, no, it's
then,
true.
I mean, then there's Kevin Costner in Waterworld. And then there's Kevin Costner in, I mean, I could go on, but so I don't dislike him. I actually think he's a rather, interesting man, you know, cause, you know, he was in JFK, right?
Oh, he was great in JFK.
Oliver Stone's JFK. So, you know, which is a great movie. I don't have a voodoo doll of Kevin Costner where I go, hate. No, I think largely I wouldn't avoid a movie if he was in it or not in it.
See, here I was going to try to spread a little hate and discontent and suggest that your opinion of Kevin Costner dropped greatly after the Madonna movie.
No.
Yeah, see, unfair of me.
You know, I hold the biggest grudge for the whole Robin Hood abomination thing because I think I said at the time that who would have made a better Robin Hood at the time? I don't know if you remember having this conversation with me.
I don't think so, but enlighten
me. Pierce Brosnan.
Oh, yeah. Well, now, was he still in his Remington Steele days at that point?
Well, it was after Remington Steele. It would have most certainly have had to have been, I would think.
But it was well before his Bond period.
Yes. It would have to have been.
Yeah, and that's part of the whole, that was part of the MGM broccoli problem, but we won't even go there.
And I don't have any knowledge of that, so I will defer to your expertise.
Actually, just to... if you like James Bond movies, let me suggest you listen to the podcast by Matt Gorling, I believe, and Matt Myra called James Bonding. They
okay.
talk about James Bond movies. They spend – their podcast is longer than the actual movie that they're talking about.
Oh, excellent.
And these guys are into it. I'm not even a big James Bond fan, but I love listening to their program because they are so into it.
What? You're not a James Bond fan?
Well, not really.
Oh, come on.
I mean, there are lots of James Bond movies that, you know, the Roger Moore period that we grew up, or I grew up in at least. But
okay, well, something you may or may not know about me, there's a couple Bond stories. Do you want to go into this story now,
sure.
Or do you want me to?
Yeah, because
okay.
Big Trouble really doesn't, you know, it's not a huge topic, especially since you weren't super thrilled with it. Although, you know what, let's talk about James Bond in just a second, because let me just insert one last thing about Big Trouble. Here's
sure.
the reason, I mean, not only because I love the novel, I totally recommend the novel, even now, even I mean, whether you like the movie or not, the novel's great because every character is richer, obviously, because there's more time to spend on them. But, and there's also, I didn't realize that they didn't play up the music that was, that the kids liked. And in the novel, the music is kind of a big part of it, and it's just hilarious. The reason why it was a $45 million budgeted movie that ended up making worldwide $8.3 million as a return.
Oof.
Yeah. Is because it was scheduled to come out on September 22nd, 2001.
Oh, dear.
And there was a big bunch of press, a bunch of money to spend on advertising for it. Well, then, of course, September 11th, 2001 came along, and a movie that's all about terrorists bringing a weapon of mass destruction onto a plane or into an airport.
Oops.
So they pulled the plug on that movie at that point. They just totally, they yanked all the advertising. They yanked it off of the schedule. They ended up releasing it in April of 2002 to almost no advertising.
Well, yeah. And I imagine that they probably had to, contractually, they had to do something with it.
Oh, yeah. Well, for $45 million, you got to try to get something out of it, I'm sure. And with that kind of a cast, because even, I mean, now the cast seems like all-star. At the time, I mean, these were all, except maybe for Sofia Vergara, everybody else was a name brand person. You know, they had to do something with it. It's just a shame because there was no way. In fact, I was going to argue that the critics were overly harsh about it because of the time that it was, you know, released in. Had it come out 3 months before, I think it would have been a whole different reception, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe not.
It's possible.
And you didn't like it as much as I did, so there we go. And I probably had as many fond memories of the book, you know, to rely on when I'm watching the movie.
Yeah, and again, I think that had I read the book, there would have been, I could have added some better, not better, I could have added some more detail that would have made it a little funnier to me, but I think I was missing some of, I think there were some inside jokes that I was missing that they just didn't have in the book. I'm sorry, that they just didn't have in the movie.
Well, yeah, and there wasn't, you're right, there was so much going on that sometimes connecting the dots, maybe they probably were a little sloppier, but I didn't realize it because I'm relying on the original source material to fill in all the blanks for me. So would you recommend people watch Big Trouble?
I think it's a movie worth watching. If nothing else, just to watch the Tucci Vergara foot. Because I will admit, that made it worth watching to me.
Oh, because I had not remembered that either when I was watching it. I had forgotten that whole part of it because it's not integral at all to the plot.
Oh, no. Well, except I was thinking, like, why would they have even, why is she even a necessary character? Except that she is because, you know, it's the whole tension of her running away from him and getting caught and that whole Jennifer, here I go again.
Jennifer Jason Lee.
God, I don't know. Why I'm hung up
that's
on that.
That's so hilarious.
That whole Jason Lee thing. So I was trying to think of ways that could have been pared down, but then I couldn't creatively make it happen myself. So,
well, and there were so many moving parts to getting everybody all in the same place together.
Yeah, and I think that was the other I think there were too many, that's a good way to put it, too many moving parts. You are correct.
Okay, so I recommend it. But at this point, I recommend the novel more. But
yeah, I would say if you have the option between the movie and the book, read the book and then maybe watch the movie just as kind of like, hey, it's great to see all these actors and what they were doing in 2001.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, the other thing is, what I would not recommend is if your only option to see this movie is to pay $18 to buy it on Amazon, don't do that.
Yeah, that would have made me, your name would have been a curse word for a while.
Yeah, no, this is definitely a $5 bin. So, okay, so let's talk about James Bond then.
So, to give due credit where credit is due, many years ago, for Christmas, I received the James Bond box set.
And this is all the movies from?
All of the movies, up to the point before, so it had everything up to Casino Royale, the reboot.
Okay, so
it did
so
not have it.
Was...
It was pre-Daniel Craig.
Okay.
But it was a set of all of the movies.
Yeah.
And it was given to me, Travis. We got it for me for Christmas. Maybe Derek and Travis or Travis. Somehow, either the boys bought it for me or one of the boys bought it for me. But it ended up being a Christmas present. Because previously, my New Year's tradition had been, so a little detail about my New Year's, for about 3-4 months leading up to New Year's, we will buy horrible, unique, new, interesting, crazy, delicious frozen hors d'oeuvre things or other semi-hors d'oeuvre things. And what we do New Year's Eve is we have this plethora of strange and new wondrous hors d'oeuvres and drink champagne and watch James Bond movies all night long. That's been kind of my tradition for the last 5 or 6 years because I'm too old to go out and drink and the whole drunk driver thing. And, you know, so I'm pretty sensitive. I'd just rather be home. I received the whole box set of them. And of course, Travis is like, well, I've never seen any of them, which I was like, oh no, this will not stand. So for a while we were watching a movie a weekend, you know.
And did you do them in order then?
Oh yes. We watched them in order. And the Roger Moore campy stuff was a little uncomfortable at points because it was just campy bad, which in the spirit of that it was, you know, it was campy bad. You know, and Timothy Dalton, all right. George Lazenby, wow.
Well good or well bad?
Ooh, that movie was just bad.
Now, was that the movie where the seagull or pigeon does a double take?
That sounds about right. That sounds about right.
Well, that's the movie where he falls in love, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It almost doesn't fit in the canon. It almost doesn't even fit in any of the movies, because it's on Her Majesty's Secret Service. It's kind of a strange... It's just kind of a strange movie in the middle of the series that, I don't know, it just kind of like a big question mark. And they decided not to recast him again, which I think is maybe the only thing that saved the series. And I don't think he did that horrible a job. I just don't think he was, I don't think that he was really cut out to be James Bond.
Well, and if I remember correctly, the reason why Lazenby got it is because Sean Connery asked for too much money.
That would seem about right.
And then Sean Connery came back for a movie or two after Lazenby, am I right?
Sounds right.
And then Roger Moore came along?
Correct.
See, and all I remember, you know, from my youth is the Roger Moore. And, you know, of course, the notion of Sean Connery being the better of the James Bonds. But I hadn't seen the original James Bond movies. And from what I understand, Sean Connery believes in real life that, you know, if you've tried everything else, it's okay. Sometimes you got to hit a woman.
I mean, well, but those movies were also made in a very different time, and I'm not defending. Believe me, I'm not defending any of the kind of misogynistic, chauvinistic, sexist. But that's what makes those movies kind of endearing and classic, is because you have to imagine that they are period pieces.
Well, it's true. Yeah, by now they definitely are.
You know, because some of it, you know, you go back and some of it's Cold War related, and there's no Cold War anymore. You know, the Russians aren't the evil...
Oh, but wait, you know, it's coming back.
Well, yeah, but...
Two words.
But still.
Crimea River.
Yeah, exactly. So there's that. But, you know, the technology has changed much. And, you know, and so it's interesting. And then, of course, you can see, you know, the change of James Bond from being this physical spy man to this gadget guy, back to being a man who just gets the crap kicked out of him. And, you know, Pierce Brosnan, I think, did a really good job. I think Roger Moore did a pretty good job. I think Sean Connery did an excellent job. I think Daniel Craig has done a very good job. I think that Casino Royale was the most fantastic way they could have rebooted the series. The turd that came after that movie, which was the Quantum of Solace.
Yes.
Should have just never happened. They should have just shelved it, because it was really just awful.
You know, it's so funny. Again, I'm not a huge fan, so I can't, you know, immerse myself into the whole canon like you are. But when I watched Casino Royale, I thought, snooze fest.
Really?
And maybe it's because I was used to the Roger Moore thing where, you know, eventually he was going to, you know, every 15 minutes there was going to be a chase of some kind, and usually on some sort of exotic craft.
Oh, sure. I thought Casino Royale with the car chases and the hand-to-hand combat and the, you know, I very much thought that Casino Royale was very much, very much a fantastic movie. Quantum of Solace, just a big steamy pile.
And then Skyfall?
I'm sorry?
What about Skyfall?
I liked Skyfall. Skyfall was good. If Skyfall had been the second movie after Casino Royale, I would have said that's a great pairing. And in fact, in my brain, I just delete Quantum Solace. Actually, I have a 3-pack of Blu-ray of the 3 Daniel Craig movies, and I will watch Skyfall, but I will not watch Quantum Solace. I have seen Casino Royale probably a couple dozen times.
Well, and, you know, as far as I'm concerned, and Drew actually asked me a question, because we're going to do Creepshow and the Creepshow movies, and we were talking about it beforehand, and he suggested that we start off by discussing the different ways in which we go into watching a movie. Because, you know, we look at, you and I look at movies differently as well. I mean, we go in, like, I can pretty much suspend disbelief for the entire movie. And as long as it's not really stretching it, I'm not going to groan, and I'm not even going to try too hard to figure out the ending of the movie. I just want to let it kind of wash over me. Whereas I think you go into it, and you want to know, maybe you get this from our mom, you want to guess who the bad guy is right from the beginning.
Well, No, actually, I don't. It's a failing I have. I wish I could turn it off, but sometimes my brain just goes there. And I think that comes from not unlike our mother. I shouldn't keep saying your mother.
No, I know.
unlike our mother, because the audience line won't understand. But yeah. unlike our mother, I think I read enough Agatha Christie novels and Patterson novels that I'm always trying to guess what the next. You know, what's around the next corner. My problem is that when I go to movies, I can't turn it off. And sometimes it will get away from me very quickly. And then I will just absolutely ruin it for myself. And I'm trying to get better with that because it really does kind of suck. I love when a movie surprises me though. I love when I'm not able to figure it out. So those are the kinds of movies that I'm like, I didn't see that and I'm glad I didn't see it and awesome. And I do try to suspend my disbelief, but sometimes if it's science-y or if it's real world data, if it's something that's just so egregious, it takes me so far out of the movie that I'm just like, oh, you have ruined the movie for me. So,
well, and I think,
and I'm hyper, I know I'm hypercritical and I know it's a failing and I'm hoping to improve on that.
Well, but I'm not I'm not even considering it a failing. I just think it's the way that, you know, you look at it. And I do the same thing, except I don't. Like, I know I went with a friend of mine who I won't identify just because I haven't asked her if it's okay to talk about her on the podcast, but she and I went to see Sixth Sense, not knowing anything about it. In fact, we ended up getting there a little bit late and had to, like, sit near the front row. I was like, oh, this is a nightmare, like, opening night, and I don't even know why I had that day off or whatever. Anyway, so we went and saw this movie, and at the very beginning of The Sixth Sense, a spoiler alert, you know, there's the whole scene where Donnie Wahlberg and Bruce Willis, you know, Donnie Wahlberg ends up shooting Bruce Willis.
Right.
And then it says, like, you know, it flashes forward. And like 2 years later or something, the person I went with says out loud in the theater, that wasn't just the end of the movie, was it? And then we saw the whole movie and she was as surprised as anyone when it turns out, you know, this twist at the end. But it was so funny because I'm thinking, oh. Come on, don't ruin it for me.
I was going to say, there's a movie theater full of people that are going to lynch you.
Well, exactly. But again, it wasn't her fault.
And in this day and age, they might shoot you, so you have to be careful.
That's true, yeah. So don't even text to somebody, oh, this can't be, but I think it is. But, but see, I will have the same critical reaction, though, at the end of the movie. Like, I will let the movie take me along, but when it gets to the end, it has to justify any kind of feeling I've now attached onto the characters.
Right.
If you make me feel, which is a successful thing you're doing as a filmmaker, if you make me care about your characters, then don't treat them crappy at the end.
And I would agree with that.
That's my only, it's just a simple request.
So you and I are in agreement as much as that, but I love those kinds of movies that they just get me. I love those.
Oh, yeah.
My problem is but sometimes I can't shut it off.
Exactly. And I don't want to be manipulated by cheap ways. Again, that's more nitpicky. We can talk about individual examples of that. Back to Bond for just a second. I mean, this another thing as far as I'm concerned about canon. I don't find a lot of that so precious. Like the Star Wars movies, you know, we all grew up at some part of the Star Wars spectrum. I mean, it hit me just about right. But you weren't too far behind anyway. So we all grew up with Star Wars as a big thing. Like it or not, it was a big part of our growing up. So when they did the second set of three movies, sure, there were expectations. And the fact that they chose to go a different direction than, say, oh, I don't know, most everybody wanted them to go. You know, it's not like they erased the original movies.
I think that many people felt it was very, very disrespectful because the movies were made. I mean, you make movies for an audience. You're not making a movie for yourself. If you're making a movie for yourself, then you're doing it for the wrong reason.
Oh, but I think George Lucas hasn't gotten that memo.
Oh, no, I absolutely agree with you. Oh, I definitely agree. He hasn't gotten that memo. I think I've seen one of the new movies.
Yeah, well, I don't even recommend them. I mean, the only thing I can recommend about the first one is that Greg Proops is in it.
Well, and this is gonna hurt my geek cred, my nerd cred, but I'm not a big Star Wars fan. I never was a big Star Wars fan, and of course this is where the flames will start because I'm a huge Star Trek fan. So I am a Trekkie. I don't know what the Star Wars people are called. Yeah. I am a Trekkie. I'm not a Lucas-y. I don't know what the Unisphere is or whatever.
Yeah. I don't know. It's funny because I totally remember feeling somehow the need, although I guess not because of my friends or anything, but you know, there was just a different camp. It was sort of like being an Elvis fan or a Beatles fan. You can't be both. It's like, you know what? It turns out you can be both.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think my recollection, I've always been a little younger than you. My recollection of the urgency of wanting to go see those movies, I think came from Dad. Because I remember being in California and being dragged to one of the movies. I think it was Empire Strikes Back.
It had to have been, because it was like 79.
Because I remember the movie being okay, but I remember burning my ass in the black vinyl seat of the car in California. That's my everlasting memory of that film. Not the film, but my ass getting blistered from the seat. From the pleather or plinal or you know, faux vinyl or whatever, the 1979 Monte Carlo or whatever the hell it was that we had in California.
Well, you know, second degree burns and, well, arguably the best of the three movies, but also the most downer of the three movies.
My recollection of those movies is, they're okay. I haven't really gone back and watched them much again. You know, they're on every now and then TV and I'll watch them for a couple minutes and I'll be like, I gotta go watch some paint dry or something. And they didn't captivate me like the Star Trek movies have.
Well, and you mean the movies or do you mean the television programs?
No, the television program, not so much. The television program's okay.
But you're a fan of strictly the movies?
Well, okay, there's more to it than that.
Well, no, that sounded more critical than I meant.
Star Trek, the first series, the Shatner Roddenberry original series, television series, it was okay.
Yeah, exactly. It was also 1967.
Sure, groundbreaking at the time.
Yeah.
You know, because they have a big, strong black woman and a strong Asian man and a Russian. So they have a lot of diversity. The TV series, okay. I mean, and I'll watch it. If I flip a channel and it's on, I'm like, I'll invest 45 minutes in watching Shatner's overacting. And I have a soft spot for the Shat, so even to this day. The movie's much better to me than the series, except for that one Star Trek movie, which most fans just don't admit exists.
Do you mean the first one?
No. The first one was fine. The second one was good. You know, the third one even, but I think it was the fourth one.
Well, okay.
The one where Spock's brother and this is another box set that I own. I own all the movies. The one where Spock's brother tries to take him to see God. I think that was Star Trek V.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Awful.
Yeah, because,
awful.
Okay, now, this, again.
Six was Undiscovered Country, and that was, you know, the final in the original Star Trek series, which moved into, you know, Star Trek Next Generation TV show, loved it.
Oh, yeah.
Star Trek Next Generation movies, loved it. Deep Space Nine, loved it. It was over the top. Star Trek Voyager, loved it. I'm watching it on Netflix all over again. And then you get to the horrible Scott Bakula Enterprise, which just should have never seen the light of day. I like the movies. I like the TV shows. But to me, the Star Trek movies, to me, because I think they were, to me, they seemed less futuristic and more hopeful. They resonated more with me than the Star Wars movies because those were so far, to me, more futuristic and just bleak and, you know, just terrible, terribly dark and, you know, full of death and murder and mayhem and.
Oh, and Star Wars is great because the original Star Wars series, because, you know, you're basically a Democrat. Or you're not even a Democrat. You're actually an insurgent trying to bring down the government. I mean, you're rooting for the bad guys the entire time. Even though, I mean, from my perspective now, I mean, it's sort of this, of course, Kevin Smith did a better job explaining this in Clerks as far as, you know, the fact that when they blew up the Death Star, they killed a bunch of government contractors. Not in the first movie, but the ones who were building the Death Star and the Jedi.
Right. Right.
But, you know, I mean, even though the government is evil, you know, really, you're trained to root for the rebels, you know, which is great,
right,
until America now is fighting a war overseas, or more than one war overseas, where we're the bad guys and the rebels are the, or, you know, anyway, that's a whole different thing of politics. I don't necessarily want to get into it in a podcast environment, but yeah, in Star Wars or Star Trek, you're, you know, the government is the good guy for the most part.
Yeah.
You know, and you have your rebellious leader in Kirk, or I don't guess who would be the Picard wouldn't be a rebel necessarily.
No, he was very much kind of a rule mate. Well, he had his moments, though.
Yeah.
I mean, but then we're getting a whole wormhole of that. But
well, yeah, and I'm, you know, I'm not here. I don't know enough to speak intelligently about either series now. I mean, even though I watched them at the time, you know, I'm not one of those fans that could just quote chapter and verse of either canon.
Well, I'm just going to pretend you didn't say that.
Okay, come on.
Because yeah, we're related, and I just can't have that in my family.
Anyway. Yeah. Oh, okay, I guess what I was getting at was, and this may not even make through post-editing, but the comedian Will Anderson from the TOFOP podcast. I'm afraid I'm just going to quote other people's podcasts all day long, but you know, it's kind of where I get some of my information these days. But you know, he likens the uproar over when it was announced that Ben Affleck was going to be the next Batman.
Yeah,
you know, people were going crazy on the internet, which is of course what people do on the internet. That shouldn't be a good, you know, barometer for how real people are thinking. Hopefully.
Well, and I don't mean to be. Who cares? Michael Keaton was Batman.
Well, exactly.
Who can say that Ben Affleck won't be a great Batman?
Well, and if you love Christian Bale as Batman, all those movies will still be available to you.
Well, somebody's got to do the job, and
well,
so
yeah,
you're just gonna have to go with it, because sometimes you're gonna have to let somebody else have the torch.
Yeah, well, and that's the James Bond thing. I mean, if you didn't like one James Bond, then, you know, wait a decade and you'll get a new one.
Sure.
And see also Doctor Who.
I'm sorry, see what?
See also Doctor Who.
Well,
because, you know, James Bond can be a Time Lord, arguably.
Well, and here's another ticking time bomb for me. I've never liked Doctor Who.
Oh, that's okay. I mean, you know,
I was never able to get into it. I was never able to watch it from the original PBS series that was just god awful. I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. I will get death threats from the original PBS series that I just couldn't wrap my head around.
By PBS, you mean BBC series broadcast on PBS?
Yeah. Sorry. Yes. Exactly.
Because the people that will lynch you actually probably watched it on BBC.
That's probably true too. And then there's the, you know, then there's the movement to, you know, the newer series, which I also just couldn't get it. And I wanted to, but I watched a couple episodes and I just couldn't do it.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I mean, fair enough. It's, again, it's the Star Trek thing. It's what you grew up with. You know, I mean, I watched the old, you know, 60s Star Treks, and or actually better example probably for me is the Twilight Zones, you know, the 60s Twilight Zones.
Mm-hmm.
And they're mostly morality tales, and they're pretty cheesy, and the good ones have been redone probably in better ways, with the possible exception of the Electric Grandmother. Anyway, so I can go back.
Call back.
Yeah, so exactly. So I could watch all of those things, but, you know, through the veil of nostalgia, I'm just happy to see Burgess Meredith, you know, or Jack Klugman, or one of the many other actors who are on, you know, many of those episodes or TV at the time or in movies later. I mean, you know, to me, it's just a nostalgia trip too. And I don't mind that at all. You know, and if it turns out that they don't actually hold up, like the Outer Limits to me, maybe, you know, cause I didn't see them at the time. I don't even know. I mean, I don't think they're nearly as good quality, and they're a slightly different genre for the most part. But, you know, they didn't have as quality writing, of course, as Twilight Zone. But, you know, it's what you grew up with. If you watched it when you were a kid, you're probably going to like it, you know? My wife, you know, my wife can, her favorite method, if she could choose what she had, like, atmospherically as she was drifting off to sleep every night, it would be a rerun of Three's Company. Any show would do. It wouldn't even matter because they're all the same.
Are you trying to say that Three's Company is like every other show?
No, I'm trying to say that Three's Company, every episode of Three's Company is all the same. They have one plot device, and it works great, and it's lovely.
Yes.
It's very comforting.
I would agree with that. Repetition, repetition, repetition.
Yeah. Of course, she was the one, because again, it turns out I'm not a hugely deep thinker when it comes to these sort of things. She was like, oh yeah, Three's Company is all about misunderstanding. I'm like, wait. Did somebody tell this to you? It's like, no, it's every single episode. It's all about someone makes a misunderstanding and it compounds and it's funny and there you go. At the end of it, the misunderstanding is worked out and everybody goes home happy. Like, wow, that's brilliant. I never thought about it. It makes perfect sense. I just turned it on and Jack and Chrissy and Janet and Mr. Roper, Mrs. Roper, Mr. Furley, whatever. Larry.
Yeah.
I didn't realize there was a system. Now I have to look at systems, you know? Speaking of which, actually, just to go way off a field, but that's kind of what we do here. Let me recommend a book to you, probably not for the first time in the case of you, but for the listeners, let's say. Philip Rosenthal has a book called It's a Good Thing You're Funny. And who Philip Rosenthal is he was the showrunner for Everybody Loves Raymond.
Okay.
And the audiobook is fantastic because not only does he read it, but he actually has recordings of like speeches he gave or presentations he made, and he just cuts those right in. I mean, you get to listen to like, you know, the speech he made to some sort of award thing or some sort of dinner, and instead of just him quoting himself, he just plays you the audio. And it's a nice, I mean, he talks about his growing up and how he became, you know, a writer and a showrunner and what all that means. But it also talks about the whole, how you put that kind of a show together and why it works. Like, spoiler here, one of the things that he wanted to make sure he did when they did Everybody Loves Raymond was they never put any kind of, they never put anything newsy in it. Every show is evergreen. They didn't reference any political event. They didn't reference really any politicians or anything because they wanted...
So it's timeless.
Exactly. It's timeless. Yeah. They're not discussing any kind of topical issues. Topics. I don't know. I'm losing my words at this point.
No.
But yeah, it's timeless.
It's not topical.
Yeah. And all it is, and the other thing he said was, in the writer's room, he's like, you can't put anything at all in the script that has not happened to you or a real person. Like, aliens cannot come and land in Ray's backyard unless it happened to you, because these have to all be real family things. And you can take an idea and exaggerate it for comedic value or whatever, but everything essentially has to be possible.
Otherwise, I respect that.
Oh, yeah, because otherwise it loses its integrity.
Yeah, otherwise it becomes Alf.
Well, yeah, and, you know, again, Alf is fine, I suppose, although I haven't seen them lately. But although I believe there may be Alf in our inheritance somewhere. Somebody's going to get a set of Alf. Anyway, but yeah, you know, you can go and watch. I mean, you know, because I read the book, now I have even a warmer spot in my heart for Everybody Loves Raymond. Because you watch those shows and it's, you know, it's great. Everything he talks about works. So if you at all love, you don't even have to like Ray Romano. Just read the book. It's a Good Thing You're Funny. He's also self-deprecating too. There's also.
I like him a little bit. I can't tolerate a lot of him, but every now and then I'll watch a show. I'll catch it on a rerun and I'll be like, this isn't horrible.
Well, you know, what's funny is, you know, Ray's parents are basically the Rosenthal's parents, who are Jews, and Ray's parents are Italians, and it's basically the same thing. You know, you've got the same kind of stereotypes working, so all the stories work if you just make them Italian. And there's a there's a documentary, and I can't remember what the documentary is called, but it's when they offered to one of the things they do is they'll take an American show, kind of like we steal all the English shows, the British shows. Well,
yeah.
Eastern Europe will take all our shows. So, in fact, one of the biggest shows in Russia was the Russian version of The Nanny. So, after that became a big hit, they came to Philip Rosendahl and said, "Hey, you know, would you like to sell this idea to, you know, to Russia?" And he's like, they wanted him. I don't think he had the right to just say no, but they wanted him to be a part of it. He says, "Oh, well, I'll go over there and be part of it if I can bring a film crew and do a little documentary about it, so at least I'll have something to show for it." And they said, "Okay, that works." Well, what's hilarious is you see in this documentary, he goes to Russia to sell this, you know, Everybody Loves Raymond thing. And because of the difference in cultures, they wanted to change everything about the show that made the show funny. And they could not understand why changing everything would have such a big difference to it. So that's what we're seeing too. And I can't remember the name of it. Maybe I'll throw it in the notes. But yeah. So we went from, you know, a Tim Allen movie up through James Bond and Star Wars and Star Trek. And now we're at Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yeah, that's quite the circle.
Yeah, which is about how this is going to go if we're successful.
Yeah, I was going to say, we could end this whole by talking about soap. So.
We could, but I'm not going to. Although soap equals Fight Club equals Chuck Palahniuk, and you know, it all works out, but it's fine.
I love soap. Soap was a great series.
Oh, you mean the show Soap?
Yes.
Okay, that's okay. I'm sorry.
Did you think I physically meant soap?
I thought literally you meant soap.
No, the greatest of all sitcoms of all time that was absurd and over the top.
Yes, I agree.
I was thinking entertainment. I wasn't thinking cleanliness.
See, and I'm thinking soap, you know? Anyway, yeah, well, you know. There's plenty to
do. Okay, well, good luck editing all that out.
Yeah, well, or not, you know. The longer this goes on, I think the less I'm going to want to edit, hopefully the less I'll have to edit because, you know, we'll have
better edits. Look, and I don't mind sounding as ridiculous as possible because I sound ridiculous in real life, so it's all fine by me.
Yeah, that's how I feel, too. It's, you know, there's only so much I can, as I was telling people, had them listen to one of the first shows. I was like, you know, there are things I can change in the sound quality, but I can't change what I sound like so much.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, I can change some things, other things, not so much. Anyway, so, red lights for next week, or do you have any other ideas?
Nope, that works for me.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you for your time. And,
all right.
As always, leave us good comments on iTunes, and we're always available at show@notinacreepyway.com.
Very good.
So, for myself, Eric, and Brother Jay,
good evening.
Good evening.